This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Philip Lopate about his book, A Mother's Tale. It's a memoir and a really interesting story about his mother. It's not any old mother. It's his mother. How are you, Phil?
I'm good.
Thanks for doing this.
I'm not entirely sure that I would call it a memoir myself. It seems to be that, but it's as much a play as a memoir because it's based on tapes that I did with my mother 30 years ago, and then I let them molder in the closet for 30 years, not daring to listen to them, and then I listened to them about a year ago and started transcribing them and then writing essayistic reflections around. So it ends up being a kind of triangle between my mother, my younger self, and myself now.
So what was it that prompted you to record her? I have some thoughts, but I'm kind of curious to know what got you to do that in the first place. And that's a pretty lengthy set of tapes.
Yeah, it was over 20 hours. And my mother was a great storyteller, but that wouldn't have been enough, I think. It was also that I had written a few pieces in which she was a character, and she had taken umbrage and said, I'm going to set this record straight. And there was also a kind of dynamic between us of a mutual wariness, you could say, where we were both, egotists and narcissists, and we both circled around each other, and I wanted to clear the air, basically. I wanted to get her to tell her story and also to try to give up some of her grudges, because my mother was an amazingly good grudge keeper. She could keep grudges for 50, 60, 70 years.
This is something I'm familiar with in my own family life, and I imagine quite a few, but your mother was really almost extreme.
She was extreme, yes.
She kept grudges having to do with her childhood?
Yes, exactly.
Against her family members?
Yes. The story I tell in the book is how when her sister Mary died, when she was about 80, and my mother was probably about 65 at the time, I went out with my mother to the grave site where they were digging the grave, and there's this kind of custom to shovel a few shovels full of dirt onto the coffin, and my mother said in a rather loud voice to all assembled, "That should keep the old bitch." So she wasn't a sentimentalist. You could give her that, you know.
Well, there's a lot of things about your mother that are fairly striking. I mean, and I think that one theme is the size of her personality, which was pretty big.
Yes.
That relates to your father, too, which we should talk about. Yeah. But it sort of goes back to what my question about why you did this. It was sort of, when you're a child and your parent or parents have big personalities, that sets you up. Yeah, there are two, and there are various ways that people deal with their big personality parents.
Exactly. And I think that writers are often the ones in the family, particularly if it's a large family, who are the observers, who don't sort of talk all the time. And so my mother definitely had a larger than life personality, and she ended up becoming an actress. And I sort of developed a personality in response to that, that was more more detached, less histrionic, and basically more quiet and observant, you could say,
and distant, maybe. She seemed, of course, it's hard. The book tells you a lot about her.
Yeah.
She just seemed like a person who would be a difficult mother because she didn't trust people to love her and didn't know how to love in a kind of unconditional way.
That's certainly true. She lost her parents when she was fairly young, 10 or 11 years old. She lost her mother and father. And she was very mistrustful, you could say. And she was very flirtatious and very mistrustful. So she was always trying to win people's love and approval, and then she was mistrusted. The example I give is I was maybe six years old, and I'd say, "Mommy, Mommy," and climbing all over her, and she said, "What do you want? You want me to give you some money?" You know, she just didn't trust that her kids would love her, and it's sort of strange because you're a kid and you think, "What is this?" You know, it's confusing to have your own motives be questioned. Right? Of course, kids are looking out for their own interests. You know, maybe they want candy as well as a kiss from their mom. You know,
but she didn't know how to distinguish a kid's needs for an adult's wants.
Yeah, in some ways, she was always the child.
Yeah.
And once I figured that out, I figured out how more to deal with her. But she had large needs, and she was in touch with them. And then she married this man, my father, who was sort of a self-taught intellectual, rather passive and quiet. And as often happens in that dynamic, the wife wants something from the husband, you know, wants to shake him up somehow, you know. And my mother was really theatrical, and my father was the opposite, you know. So half the time my mother acted as though her whole life had been ruined and thrown down the toilet because she'd married the wrong man. And the other half of the time she would say, "Well, who cares about him? He's like a little fly, you know."
Well, yeah, it was definitely, their relationship is very unusual. Mm-hmm. Maybe, or maybe not, I don't know. Maybe it's more common than I realize. Mm-hmm. But it was that she was so nasty to him.
Yes.
On such a deep level that it's hard to understand why he would, I mean, you say he's passive, but that means he internalized an awful lot of self-loathing on some level.
Right.
From her, that he, and he was willing to continue the relationship,
right,
despite some, you know, major problems.
Yes.
That they had. And of course, your mother, and what she talks, it was also striking that she talked to you about her infidelity. You know, it's to me anyway, it's something like, you know, you wouldn't expect your parents to talk about their sexual escapades.
She talked about her sexuality, and she talked about her affairs, of which there are many, because I think it was an important part of her character and her desire, and also she had the kind of courage, you might say, not to hold anything back, and I was giving the opportunity, and so she did. She was quite forthcoming about all that stuff, which is a little bit of a shock for a son, you know.
Yeah.
I knew some of this stuff anyway. But the funny thing is that during the 30 years that I let the tape sit in the closet, I'd forgotten some of the revelations, you know, because they were just a little too emotionally upsetting, you know. So I managed to repress some of this stuff. And then when I started listening to the tapes, I thought, first of all, I thought, this is pretty juicy material. I mean, I'm a writer. I've written about 16 books. And the completely cold-blooded side of me thought, hey, this stuff is really interesting, you know? So I would sit there and transcribe it. And every once in a while, I just start gasping. And I had to stop transcribing, saying, oh, my goodness. That guy too, you know.
All these people that were in your life,
in my life,
that you now you realize, exactly, as an adult, what was really going on. But you have to give your mother a lot of credit on,
yes,
some levels for being a kind of willing and able to live her life the way she wanted to. Whether she was happy or not, it's not clear.
Yes,
but you know, she acted, and she was a sexual being who, you know, participated in her desires, which not everybody gets to do.
She was bold. I often think of my mother and father as Eros and Thanatos, you know. Mm. He was sort of like preparing for death when he was 21 years old, although he lived into his 80s. And she wanted to live. And I have to say that she gave us a model, an example for boldness, just to do what you need to do.
Yeah.
So I think that I ended up being a strange mixture of the reflective and the active, you know.
Well, one thing that struck me about your father, I think you said this near the end of the book, that you recorded 20 hours of your mother, you recorded 1 hour of your father.
Right.
That was the most you could get out of him.
Yes.
But what he talked about, I thought, was very revealing. You were trying to get him to say, why did you stay with her?
Right.
Why did you put up with this? Why did you
exactly.
allow your life to be so miserable? And he said, well, and I thought this was really the key thing. He said that when they were young, your mother had an affair, which he found out about, and she talked about that too.
Yeah.
And then he said he choked her. He was going to kill her.
Yeah.
And he realized, I'm not a person of violence. I'm not a person of action. And he kind of retreated into this shell. But you got to get the feeling that it's almost like his entire life was about that moment.
Well, you know, we all make narratives out of our life, you know, and whether they're real or accurate, we shape them according to different moments, and so he had his hands around my mother's throat, and he thought, I'm going to kill her. No, I can't kill her. First, he thought, if I kill her, that's it. The problem will be solved. I'll go to jail. They'll give me the electric chair. But this is a weird thing for a father to tell a son also, you know, they both were sort of like, breaking all the rules in that regard. But then when I talked to my mother about it, she said, nah, he never beat me in any significant way. You know, I would have broken him in half, you know, cause she outweighed him, you know,
she was a big woman.
She was a big woman. So he saw this as a peak experience, and she thought it as a minor footnote, you know?
Right, but that is an interesting, as you mentioned, sort of a dualistic approach, you know, under kind of a dualistic tension between the two of them that obviously went on.
Yeah.
Now, but at some point, she divorced him, and yet they stayed in the same home.
Well, that's a sort of New York real estate story. She had married, she was already in her 60s, and she had gotten an apartment because of her show business background in this apartment complex, Manhattan Plaza, which gave apartments subsidized to people who had been in show business. And so she got the apartment, and they moved in together, and then she divorced him, but she couldn't quite find a place to put him in yet. So they lived together for years after they were divorced. It's like that joke about the old Jewish couple, you know, they're in their 90s, and they go to the lawyer, they say, we want to get a divorce. And then the lawyer says, well, why'd you wait so long? Well, we wait till the children died, you know? So anyway, that was a grim joke, but so finally, she did put him in a senior facility, and she bragged to me that the people doing intake thought that he was her father because he looked so much older than she. He was only 8 years older than she was.
The other story that I liked, sort of grim also, mm-hmm. on another level, is that when there was a point where she said, her story was that she was leaving him, taking the girls.
Yes.
And the night that she was planning to leave, he overheard them planning this getaway.
Yes.
And according to her, gave himself a stroke, basically, that she couldn't leave.
And that was so odd because she the way she put it was that he basically faked a stroke. Well, my father was in the hospital, and let me tell you, my father had a very serious stroke, and one part of his body was paralyzed for a while. And the idea that she would think that he engineered this or that it wasn't real.
But in a way, psychologically, she might have a point. In other words, it may not be literally that he faked a stroke, but that the fact of her leaving was enough to trigger a massive reaction on him. He just couldn't live without her.
It could have, absolutely. I mean, it could have been triggered by that.
But the way she created it, it was, you know, that's part of her narrative.
But as I said in the book, at times she seemed to be trying to portray herself in a particularly hard-hearted, monstrous way, because she was drawn to drama, you know. And I do think that the one thing my mother could never talk about, the one forbidden subject, was that she had feelings for my father. And up to a certain point may actually have loved him.
But probably loved him in a lot of, it actually maybe loved him all along.
Maybe loved him all along, but and felt responsible for him, but that didn't go with her narrative.
Right. Well, but she, unlike so many, I mean, it was really interesting too that, you know, you kind of show her as a, you know, not an educated person,
right?
She came from a tough, I mean, her family had been not bad, well, not
they were
poor.
Middle class, but she had dropped out of school herself because she was a runaway.
Right. But later in her life, she went into psychological therapy.
She went into therapy, which was unusual for working class women at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, I thought that was very revealing, you know, in terms of her kind of connecting to herself and understanding who she was. And I mean, that was, I just thought that was really interesting and maybe connected in some way to her becoming an actor later in her life, you know, that she was more comfortable expressing herself than a lot of people are.
Well, I think also something that fascinated me in working with this material was coming upon my mother showing real insight. And she was a bright woman, and she would sort of have a kind of psychological understanding of things, but then she would deny it all, you know. So she would have insights, and then she would erase them, you know. And to me, it's a model of the way we all are, you know. Like we grasp something, and then it doesn't suit us, and we sort of, you know, put it under the rug again, you know. So she had this peculiar combination of real psychological insight and then a refusal to accept what she was telling herself, you know. And I do think that's fascinating, you know. To me, it's fascinating because I think we all rationalize a lot. We all, construct narratives which present ourselves in the heroic light, you know.
Yes.
And so I think
or as the victim.
As a victim, exactly. So I think my mother presented herself both as a victim and as the monster, both, you know. But I learned so much from her, you know.
So what stage, at what point in her life did the acting come about? I wasn't clear about that, you know, just sort of in terms of her life timeline. How old was she when she started
acting?
She
was over 50 when she started acting. And earlier on, she had taken singing lessons, and she had wanted to be a performer of some kind.
And she was pretty serious about that.
Yeah. She took opera lessons, took singing lessons, played the piano, But then she was working for a textile company, and they put on a company show, and she really did well with it. And after that, she just kind of decided to follow her dream, you know. And she would get these glossies made, and she'd go around to the agencies and say, "Just remember, I'm not just another pretty face," you know. At that point, my mother was kind of overweight.
But was she a character actor?
She was a character actor. She would go on tour and play Golda and Fiddler on the Roof. She was in that commercial for Alka-Seltzer. You don't have to be. Mamma Mia, what a spicy meatball!
Spicy meatball.
Yeah. And that was my mother delivering one plate of meatballs after another. And so she did a lot of this sort of character acting thing, and she had a kind of a pretty voice, you know, and she was in things like The Reluctant Debutante, and she really was made for kind of musical comedy. She was not, in spite of her histrionic way of talking about herself, she was not a tragedian. She was really more a comic on stage.
Did she have like a big voice, or was it, you know, like sort of not Ethel Merman kind of? No,
it wasn't that big. It was actually... It was actually a sweeter voice. I'm sure she would have loved to belt it out like Ethel Merman. We all knew Ethel Merman.
Well, her personality feels like somebody like an Ethel Merman or a Sophie Tucker.
Yes, exactly.
Is that accurate?
Definitely. I mean, we were very conscious of Sophie Tucker and Ethel Merman when we were growing up.
The red hot mama.
My mother really patterned her voice after those torch singers, who sang the kind of he's just my Bill, those kind of I must try to make the man love me, the kind of Helen Morgan kind of torch singers, and she could sing all those songs about love and pain,
So did you go see her perform?
I saw her perform a number of times. She definitely was riveting on stage, and I saw her when she performed in a nightclub as well. And I think that that I got some of that desire to perform. I like to give readings, I like to be in front of audiences. And my brother, as you probably know, is a radio host, So he became somebody in show business, actually.
Right. Although he's not he doesn't play that large scale, outsized role that your mother played.
He's more an enabler of other people.
Right. You and he are both storytellers.
We're both storytellers.
And maybe that comes from your mother.
Definitely. I mean, I think, as you know, I write fiction, I write personal essays, I write poems. And the one continuity in it all is that I'm a storyteller. And I love the kind of stories that are ironic or sardonic or also have some humor in them,
And do you think, how did your mother feel about you being a writer? There's a little bit of that in the book that seems a little mistrustful, maybe is the word again.
Well, everybody in my family thought of himself or herself as a potential writer. And I was the only one who became a writer. And so my father had written poems when he was younger and had been a newspaper reporter.
That's right.
So he had really given me that love of language, and the idea of working with language till you got it right. But at one point I remember telling him, "Dad, I'm going to have another book published." And he said, "Well, I haven't written poems in a long time." It was completely competitive and solipsistic, you might say.
Well, but this, your father, I think he's a really interesting character and really sad in a lot of ways.
Definitely.
Because he was cast as a failure over and over again.
Right.
That your mother, and maybe this is accurate, that he couldn't make it as the journalist, kind of undermined himself.
Yes.
And then he goes and he works for his brother.
Yes.
And he allows his brother to take advantage of him over and over again and gets screwed out of everything every time. He's sort of a
Schlemiel
or a schlemazel, right? Kind of classic. But lurking under there is the ego that says, I am a person.
Right,
I am
exactly.
capable. And so that made him almost insensitive at the same time, that he couldn't see outside of himself.
He couldn't see outside of himself. And just as my mother constructed her scenario about being a victim, his scenario was that he was a failure.
Right.
And I used to think, "Dad, you worked every day of your life. You supported a family of six, four kids. What gives you the right to declare you a failure?"
But his wife told him constantly that he was a failure.
His wife told him, and she wanted him to make more money and to push himself. And at one point, as we discussed in the book, she pushed him to try to become an insurance salesman. And if you'd ever met my father, there's nobody less likely to sell insurance than my father.
Right. He didn't have the outgoing social skills.
And I remember when he used to try to rehearse the pitch, and you weren't supposed to say, if a member of your family dies, you weren't supposed to use that word. You were supposed to say, "If someone you love passes out of the picture." And this euphemism stuck in my father's craw. He couldn't say "passes out of the picture."
Well, he's an interesting guy.
And
the other setup, I think, in that is, and you mentioned this at the beginning of the book, that your mother's family was German Jewish.
Yes.
Thought of themselves, you know, there's that whole tension between
the high Jews of
Germany.
And the East Jews.
Yes.
It was called Ostjuden, which were the Russian Jews. And the German Jews looked down on the Eastern European Jews and thought they were dirty and they came from the slums and so on. So I like to say I come from a mixed family, which was German Jewish and Russian Jewish.
Right. But that was a setup for your father too from the very beginning.
Absolutely.
That he was the lesser, you know, kind of.
But he wasn't just sweet and passive. I think he had a lot of anger inside him, which he just basically kept locked in and didn't express. But it isn't as though he was filled with the milk of human kindness, you know?
Right. Right. Well, so how do your siblings feel about this book?
Next question. One of my youngest sister, Joan, really likes the book, and she's read it twice. She was shocked at how all the mean things my mother said about my father. Another sister, we've had a falling out for many years, and she won't read the book. She insists that it's all lies, even though it's a transcript for a large part of it, and I could show her the transcript, you know, and I could give her the tapes. But there are some people who, when they see themselves in a photograph, they say, that's not me, you know? So she thinks it's all lies. And my brother, I think, is trying to keep a distance from it, frankly.
Well, so, you know, in a family, every child has a different relationship with the same parents. It's always really interesting to see how that works. And, you know, I think about that. I was just looking at some photographs from my family that I just uncovered the other day.
Yeah.
And it's just, you see the way my parents held each of us is almost different, you know,
exactly.
Because we played
it. That is so true.
You know? And I think so then when it comes time for the judgment of the parents by the children, they have different outlooks.
Absolutely. And it's funny because Louise Gluck, the poet, who I know, wrote me a letter about the book saying how much she loved the book and how she loved the experimental nature of the book, which is that it's not a classic memoir. And it has all these voices in it. And then the very last line of her letter said, I bet your siblings want to kill you. and I think what she meant was that everybody has not only their own version, but their own story and fantasizes writing that story. And I've written the family story now, you know.
Yeah. But it's also true, I think, to be fair to you, that when you tell a story, even though other people have different perspectives on it, they lived in it as well.
Yes.
And so it amplifies and kind of broadens their experience. It's like reading a story about a town you grew up in.
Yes.
But it's different experience, but it's still the place you grew up.
Absolutely.
And I think your book can be that for, I think not only for your siblings, but I think for, you know, very few of us probably had parents just like yours. I think they were quite unusual. But each of us have complicated relationships with our parents.
It's so true. And I think that it takes a lifetime and maybe several lifetimes to work out our relations to our parents. And by no means do we stay at the same place the whole time. I remember Jamaica Kincaid saying to me, you know, I used to think my mother was awful, and then I had children, and suddenly I thought, now I think I see it in a different light, you know. So we all take a long time to figure out our parents. And the other thing is that my mother, in some ways, was emblematic of a lot of women who passed through the 20th century. You know, she grew up in a time when, for instance, women were not supposed to be aware that they had a sexual nature. That was considered unladylike, you know. And also, they were supposed to find protectors in men, you know. And so my mother lived a very different kind of life, much more assertive in a way. And then she faced every one of these challenges. She was running a candy store during World War II, and after World War II, some of the concentration camp survivors came into Brooklyn, and they came into the store, and you know, she said, "I really should have been more sympathetic, but they had a chip on their shoulder. They were really annoying, and I thought, my feet are hurting, you know." So she was honest enough to admit that, you know, that her heart was not bleeding for these concentration camp survivors, you know.
I know, that was pretty interesting. I thought, you know, and I bet that was her experience was not unusual.
It was not unusual. I remember because I was a kid at the time, and I remember sometimes in our neighborhood. I grew up in Williamsburg, which was then a largely Jewish neighborhood, and there was definitely a kind of belligerent attitude on the part of some of the concentration. Understandably, you know, I mean
Yeah, chip on the shoulder is like chip on the shoulder. Like, that's like so.
So exactly. So my mother lived through the Depression, through World War II, through feminism and the civil rights movement, you know, and she had things to say about all of it.
Yeah, I think I am struck sometimes by the remarkable period of time that the people of that generation lived through. Maybe our children will feel the same way about us. I don't know.
Right.
But before we kind of close, do you mind reading just a little tiny bit,
sure,
a section from the book?
Sure.
Whatever piece I
think. The book is called A Mother's Tale, and I'm Philip Lopate, and I'll just read the opening page or so from the prologue. When I was about 8 years old, not long after I had mastered speech and a semblance of rationality, I became, or rather fashioned myself into becoming, an ideal interlocutor for my mother. She would come to me with her troubles, usually complaints about my father, and I would listen with an expression of sympathy and knowingness which I had learned to sham at an early age. What she was telling me was not so hard to grasp, even for an 8 or 9 year old. She was unhappy, dissatisfied with my father and our shabby living circumstances, and had dreams of a finer existence which included romantic love and a singing career. I nodded along, made the appropriate sounds of sympathy, and she would say something like, "I can't believe I'm talking to a child just so grown up, so understanding." I was pleased. That was my reward. Years later, I came to resent what appeared to me an inappropriate seduction. She was unburdening herself at the same time as burdening me with adult problems, such as her sexual incompatibility with my father, that were robbing me of my innocence. Still years after that, when I came to question the very notion of childhood innocence, I realized that it had been a mutual seduction. I was every bit as complicit in offering myself as her confidant as she was in taking advantage of my offer. I love my mother, and so what better way to ensure her attachment to me than by enacting a semblance of empathy? This happy arrangement lasted until I was about 14, when I began to question her accounts, or at least her interpretations of them. It seemed to me that she was being unjust in her assessment of my father, who was not nearly as blameworthy as she asserted, and I began to shift my sympathy from her to him. An unsurprising development in the individuation stage for an adolescent boy. Her long-held grudges also began to seem distorted. I started to chafe under her diva-like role in our family. Her life story dominated, while the rest of us seemed reduced to minor characters orbiting around her. Granted, it was a compelling tale, but I was beginning to assert my own narrative, however pallid by comparison.
Thank you. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Philip Lopate. He's the author of A Mother's Tale, which I think is a really terrific book, and I hope you will go out and buy it yourself. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you so much.